Well, welcome all on this incredibly nasty day of rain. But you made it, and we haven't had to get the ark out and take us all away with Noah. And the doorbell still rings, so good things. Now, we've got a session tonight on the lessons to be learned from the Pell saga and from the imprisonment, conviction and exoneration. We have three speakers. We have Father Frank Brennan, who is the author of Proceedings on the Pell... What is it? The Pell...
Observations
on the Pell Proceedings. There we are. Got it right now. We have Monica Dumit, who is from the Catholic Weekly, and we have Gerard Henderson, who is from the Sydney Institute, and also the author, most recently, of Cardinal Pell, The Media Pylon and Collective Guilt. I've reached an age where these sort of things go round in my head and don't come out the way they should. But Monica is also policy coordinator for the Sydney Diocese. That's correct. So we'll hear from Father Frank first, and 10 minutes each. We'll have a gong somewhere upstairs if you go over time, and then questions and discussion.
Thank you, Anne, and good evening, everyone. And it's very good of you to turn out on such a foul night here in Sydney. I can say that because I've flown up from Melbourne. And so given that you have come out in such foul weather, I can see that 2 years after the Pell decision, you're anxious to learn a few lessons from what I would call the Pell saga. This evening, my focus will be mainly on what lessons can be learned for the well-being of bona fide complainants and also victims of child sexual abuse. I won't focus so much on Cardinal Pell. I think it's no doubt now that he was made a scapegoat and a sacrificial lamb. His charging by VicPol was a farce. His prosecution by the DPP was a farce. The decision of the two most senior judges in Victoria was a farce, but the High Court put all that right. So Cardinal Pell, now back in Rome, presumably can get on with his life. But we still have to contemplate the situation of what lessons might be learnt for the well-being of bona fide complainants and victims, society generally, and citizens like Citizen Pell in the future who might be subjected to this sort of abuse by VicPol, the Victorian DPP, and with failure to correct by the established judiciary. So, in terms of lessons to be learnt, the first lesson to be learnt, I think, is that it's necessary that police do policing. What we had in this case was a situation where a young man who'd obviously had a very troubled history, in about mid-2014 he started speaking to his mother about abuse that had been suffered at home by a babysitter. He later spoke about abuse which had been suffered at the hands of a parish priest. There then followed some very murky months where there was contact with an outfit called Broken Rights, which was in close contact with SANO within the Victorian Police, and with a couple of legal outfits, including Walla Legal. By the end of this time, by mid-2015, we had it specified by the complainant that he had been sexually abused with his friend in the priest's sacristy immediately after a Sunday Mass. When the police went to Rome, they went there in October 2016, but you've got to recall that the complainant had given his statement in mid-2015. They obviously thought they didn't quite have enough to run on, or else VicPol thought they were going to dig into a very deep seam. And so they ran an advertising campaign on Christmas Eve 2015. You have the handout there. On one side of it is the front page of the Melbourne Age of Christmas Eve 2015. St Patrick's Centre of Police Inquiry, complete with very fine quotes from the lawyer Dr. Judy Courton. Suffice to say that this investigation brought up nothing. So the police in the end were left with nothing but Complainant J, as we might call him. They went to Rome, they interviewed Pell, and there were three senior police officers involved in this exercise. Pell said, "That's crazy. To allege this happened in that room immediately after Mass, there'd have to be a bevy of people there. priests and celebrants, money counters, sacristan, and altar servers, probably 7 to 9 altar servers. He said, go back to Sydney and interview those people. Vic Pohl went back and didn't interview one single altar server, didn't find one single concelebrant, didn't try and find one single money counter. It's called policing 101. That complainant could have been spared 2 years of trauma, to say nothing of the rest of us, if policing 101 had been done. Because what was found in the end was that it was just impossible for it to have occurred. Pell further said, look, I'd be out on the steps greeting people after Mass. I'd be accompanied by my MC, Monsignor Portelli. I just want to quote to you one paragraph from the High Court's unanimous decision 7-0. It remains that the evidence of witnesses, whose honesty was not in question, placed Pell on the steps of the cathedral for at least 10 minutes after Mass on the relevant date, placed him in the company of Portelli when he returned to the priest's sacristy to remove the vestments, and described continuous traffic into and out of the priest's sacristy for 10 to 15 minutes after the altar servers completed their bows to the crucifix. That's what you might call an accurate summary of the record of interview given by Pell in Rome in October 2016. This was the decision of the High Court of Australia, 7-0, in April 2020. You might think I'm being unduly critical of the two most senior judges in Victoria, but this is where a key lesson has to be learnt. When the populace has been motivated to think that there's all sorts of evil at play, then even the most intelligent and even the most highly placed individuals in society can lose track of the rule of law. Let me give you the key two sentences of that majority, Ferguson and Maxwell. In our view, taking the evidence as a whole, it was open to the jury to find that the assaults took place in the 5 to 6 minutes of private prayer time, and that this was before the hive of activity described by the other witnesses began. The jury were not bound to have a reasonable doubt. Let me quote to you just one more sentence from the High Court of Australia. The principal difficulty with the Court of Appeal majority's analysis is that it elides Potter's estimate of 5 to 6 minutes of private prayer time with the estimate of 5 to 6 minutes during which A and B re-entered the cathedral, made their way into the priest's sacristy and were assaulted. The two periods are distinct. What they're saying is there was no time when it was possible, no time when it was possible for Pell and those two boys to be in that room alone immediately after the Mass. Now, those in doubt about that, those who have written the books, commentators like David Marr, simply ask them, forget about evidence, give us a theory. Because there are only two possibilities. You see, it was known that what happened was that there would be an external procession where they would then come in and those at the head of the procession would bow to the crucifix, and then the key altar servers would start their duties of ferrying things from the sanctuary into the sacristy. So you'll appreciate the 5 to 6 minutes of offending had to occur either before the bow to the crucifix or after the bow to the crucifix. No other possibility. Not even Ferguson and Maxwell suggested it could have occurred during the bow to the crucifix. So, in terms of before the bow to the crucifix, look at the other side of the sheet. That simply gives you the map of the various accounts given by the complainant. According to Cardinal Pell and his lawyers, they, unlike us, heard all the evidence. They say the complainant changed his story 24 times. So when you're speaking about the credibility of a complainant, it's credible about what? Here is an individual who, of course, was convinced that something had happened to him. But the prospect that it was Pell who did these things to him in that room at that time and that place was inconceivable. You see, he basically had an idea that initially it was an internal procession. On the evidence of other Crown witnesses, it was an external procession. So ultimately, he came up with the idea that he went on a route of 408 steps with his mate. The only problem with that was it would take him at least 4.5 minutes. I've walked it. And the further problem was he would have had to have arrived in the sacristy a full minute after the initial altar servers arrived. So you'll appreciate, on the complainant's own account, it was impossible for this to have occurred in the time before the bow to the crucifix. So then we come to the time after the bow to the crucifix. And here we come now to the role of the DPP. They had to find 6 minutes. They invented things. Pell went to trial twice. The DPP prosecutor, a QC, twice suggested to the jury that what could have happened was that these altar servers had adjourned to another room for 6 minutes while Pell had his way with the boys. There was no evidence of that. It had to be retracted. It was absolutely inconceivable. And so what you have is a situation where the prosecution said, we're not saying it could have happened 15 to 20 minutes after Mass. It had to happen immediately after Mass, and it had to be either before the bow to the crucifix or after the bow to the crucifix. Policing 101 means this. Yes, as Prime Minister Morrison said in Parliament, we believe you as complainants. It means we as police will do our best. We will do the policing and we will investigate this complaint. And if what you come up with is something which could not possibly have occurred, then we will believe that you believe this is the situation. And whatever the fantasy that created it, we don't pretend to understand. The further lesson is in terms of the DPP. The DPP herself appeared in the High Court of Australia, not only misconstrued the evidence, but invented theories and even postulated that the prosecutor himself had made generous concessions which should not have been made. It was an appalling performance. So, the final word to say in terms of lessons, policing 101. Do the policing. Sarno may be an outfit very good of dealing with complainants, in which case you need another outfit within the police to oversee Sarno to ensure that proper policing is being done. Second, DPP should not invent theories. DPP should be attentive to the evidence and should not bring an indictment unless it could be established. And finally, judges should act judicially and be very careful about simply going with the mob. When we go with the mob, with the highest level of judiciary, we forfeit the rule of law. And that's why the High Court majority, 7-0, was so essential to restore the rule of law for the good of complainants, for the good of bona fide complainants, for the good of victims and for good of citizens, including those like Citizen Pell.
Thanks, Frank. Monica Dumit.
Thank you. Well, I think this is the first time I've been asked publicly to speak about the Pell saga, as Father Brennan called it. And so given that, I wanted to begin this evening by sharing a story. It was the night that Louise Milligan's ABC 730 report screened. It was Wednesday, the 27th of July, 2016. At the time, I was part of the communications team at the Archdiocese of Sydney. World Youth Day was also happening in Poland. And so a number of the Archdiocesan staff, including the communications manager and the deputy communications manager, was overseas. We knew that a program was in the works, but we didn't exactly know when it would land and when it would be screened. On the Wednesday morning, we were advised that the program would air that evening. And with most of the comms team overseas, it would be me that would be in charge of making sure statements got out to media, onto the website and everything like that. So just before 7:30 p.m. rolled around, I received a phone call from Cardinal Pell's private secretary in Rome. And what I was asked to do was to put my mobile phone underneath the television and turn the volume up really loud so that they could listen to the program as it was being aired. I don't think the ABC is available simultaneously overseas. So the program aired, obviously, and we heard all of the accusations. And it would have been the first time that the Cardinal had actually heard the full extent of the accusations made against him. For those of you who saw it in that program, we heard the swimming pool allegations. We heard the cathedral abuse allegations for which the Cardinal was ultimately convicted before the decision was quashed, and other allegations as well. The program finished and I looked at my phone sitting under the television, knowing that the Cardinal was on the other end of the line. So, you know, my hand trembled and I went and I picked up the phone And I said, you know, Your Eminence, I don't know what to say to you. He said, oh, I couldn't, to be honest, I couldn't hear a lot of it. I said, okay, that's okay, we recorded it. I'm going to type up a transcript now and we'll get it over to you. He said, look, I'm really sorry. I know it's already 8 p.m. over there. I know that there are several hours of work ahead of you. I can't help in any other way. So, you know, getting to work is actually the best thing that I can do. So don't worry about that. Anyway, so we got to work, got the transcript over to him, got the media statement settled, sent to the media up on the website and everything like that. It was about 2 a.m. and I was finally in a cab on my way home. And I got a call from the communications director from overseas. And we'd spoken maybe half a dozen times that night already. So I picked up the phone and she said, oh, is everything okay? I said, yeah, everything's fine. Statements went out. I'm in a cab on my way home. She said, are you sure? Are you okay? Are you sure you're okay? I said, I'm fine. I'm just, you know, I'll go get a few hours sleep and I'll come back to the office and deal with the media onslaught. She said, I thought you'd be fine, but the Cardinal called me. He's really worried about you. He asked me to call and check and make sure that you're okay. And so with everything else that we're talking about tonight, I want to say publicly that that is the measure of the man. To paraphrase The West Wing, while it might not have been the worst day in his life, it would have been in the top five. You know, publicly accused of horrific crimes on television, a reputation trashed, and you know, about to have this massive onslaught. And he cared enough about some low-ranking communications staffer on the other side of the world that he'd met maybe one or twice before he moved to Rome. That's the measure of the man we're speaking about tonight. And the reason I want to tell it is because when I look back on this, that's actually the most important aspect of this for me, that first and foremost, we're talking about a man who cares deeply about other people. But for the rest of my brief time this evening, what I'd like to speak about are the unanswered questions that remain 2 years after the Cardinal walked free from Barwon Prison. His unanimous acquittal on the one hand might seem like the end of the story, but it isn't. Serious questions remain, and I want to speak to them just briefly. And we'll start, as Father Frank mentioned, with Victoria Police, which in March 2013, just as the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse was getting started, established Operation Tethering. And Tethering was described as by the police as an intel probe to find out whether there were any unreported abuse allegations against Cardinal Pell. It commenced, the investigation commenced without any complaint of abuse having been made against the Cardinal, and it ran for a full year before anyone came forward with an allegation. It was a crime. It was a crime in search of a complainant. As it went on, Tethering also attempted to resurrect an abuse complaint from 2002 that had already been investigated and dealt with, but the complainant didn't want any part of it. So the first unanswered question that I have is that with all of the reported crimes and ongoing cases of child abuse in Victoria, why was a year's worth of investigative time and resources, not to mention taxpayer money, dedicated to constructing a case where no abuse had been alleged? And look, this isn't just about the Cardinal. In the 2013-2014 financial year, there were 56,515 cases reported to child protection authorities, and that's children of being at risk of significant harm, just in that year alone. 56,515 children is one child every 10 minutes being reported to authorities. And a third of those children, more than 20,000 of them, had to wait more than 2 months for their investigation to be done, while police time was instead spent on trying to find an accuser for Cardinal Pell. 2 years on from his acquittal, we still don't have an answer as to why Victoria Police was so intent on what Detective Superintendent Paul Sheridan conceded was a Get Pell operation. Nor do we have any answers as to what evidence Victoria Police had when considering using the pursuit of the Cardinal to distract from the Lawyer X scandal. So in April 2014, as details of Nicola Gobbo's informing for VicPol were coming to light, there was a suggestion that announcements about the Cardinal could distract media attention and public attention from the fact that police were using a defence lawyer as an informant against her own clients. Media and Corporate Comms Director for the police, Charlie Morton wrote to Deputy Police Commissioner Graham Ashton, telling him that there was no need for him to be accepting media invitations on the Lawyer X scandal. I quote, "The Pell stuff is coming tomorrow and will knock this way off the front page." Nothing about the Cardinal ended up appearing back in April 2014, and it's actually unclear what police had at the time, given we know that Operation Tethering, which began in March 2013, ran for more than a year before someone came forward. What exactly were they hoping to announce that day? Given the time frame, it would have been very limited information, perhaps, as again, as Father Frank mentioned, that there had been some initial conversations with Witness J, but that's probably the upper limit at what they could have had at the time. Announcing it would have been incredibly prejudicial, not only to the Cardinal, but also to their own investigation. But were they willing to trade it in order to have something big enough, as they put it, to knock the Lawyer X scandal off the front page? And what changed their mind? So they're more unanswered questions that we don't have the answer to. The following year saw a plan to arrest and question Cardinal Pell upon his return to Australia to testify at the Royal Commission. That was December 2015. By this time, Witness J had come forward and made a statement, but Victoria Police said separately that they would have had to release the Cardinal if he denied the allegations or even refused to comment, because the evidence they had at the time were not enough to retain him. That's all they ended up having by June 2017, so how was it enough that they could charge him at that point? The statements from Witness J remain the only evidence police and prosecutors had. But that wasn't to stop the next scene of this pantomime playing out. The only thing that did stop it was the Cardinal's heart condition, which prevented him from flying back to testify in person as scheduled. So the next phase of the investigation kicked in, with police immediately advertising for people to come forward, and that's the advertisement on the front page of The Age that Father Frank mentioned. Sorry, I just lost my keys. Not only did they advertise for allegations at St Patrick's Cathedral, but they also advertised to see if anyone could come forward with complaints around the Eureka swimming pools back in the 1970s. Another question is, who authorised the advertisements? And did they have any information at all about the swimming pool allegations or the details of these crimes being written before anyone came forward? None of these questions about Victoria Police have been answered, and now 2 years have passed since the Cardinal's conviction was quashed without even a hint of an inquiry. I'm not sure we'll ever get any answers to this. Perhaps we will get some answers on the other side of the world, though. So the trial of, over in Rome, the trial of Cardinal Angelo Becciu over financial misconduct and abuse of office continues. In 2016 and in 2017, the time period where the Cardinal was being questioned by police officers in Rome and ultimately charged, Cardinal Becciu authorised the transfer of $2.3 million Australian dollars to the Melbourne offices of a tech company called Newstar in a series of four transactions. And while the transfers aren't the subject of the case currently happening in Rome, the trial is delving into all of the financial dealings, including these transfers. So far, witnesses at the trial have insisted that the money was sent to the Catholic bishops in Australia for the Cardinal's defence, but it's demonstrably untrue. We know the money went to Newstar. So while there are many questions that remain, I'll leave the final question to the Cardinal himself. In a recent interview, the Cardinal said, "I have one question for Cardinal Becciu. Will he just tell us what the money was sent for?" Becciu has said he will not answer because to do so would be beneath the dignity of cardinals. Unanswered questions beneath the dignity of cardinals, and it appears also beneath the dignity of Victoria Police. And so given this is the case, I'm grateful to be here tonight amongst so many undignified friends still willing to seek the truth. Thank you very much.
And Jarrett, and you can go a bit over time since they did too.
Thanks, Anna. Always being well brought up, I always do what I'm told. Now, I'm conscious that all three speakers tonight have come to a similar conclusion while discussing different aspects of the Pell case, and that's not for want of trying. I've been willing for years to discuss the Pell case with these many antagonists, but this has not been possible. During the entire period of the Royal Commission, Victoria Police's decisions to charge Pell, the committal proceedings, the two trials, the convictions, I was never invited on the ABC to discuss the Pell case or to appear at literary festivals with such Pell antagonists as Louise Milligan, David Marr, Lucy Morris Marr and Melissa Davies, all of whom gave one-to-one interviews with journalists who agreed with them. Sometimes they discussed these things with themselves. And this despite the fact that I'd written about the case in my weekend Australian column and discussed it on Sky News and elsewhere. Since the publication of my book on the Pell case, it has not been discussed on or in the ABC, Networks 10, The Project, 60 Minutes, The Age, The Sydney Morning Herald, The Guardian Australia, The New Daily, or any other media outlets which participated in the parlon. None of the over 100 journalists, commentators, lawyers criticised in my book has taken issue with me on any aspect of the book. I am not alone. Frank Brennan's observations on the Pell proceedings, which is for sale tonight, has not been discussed on the ABC or reviewed in the Nine newspapers in Melbourne and Sydney. Likewise, Keith Windschuttle, who's here tonight, his book, The Persecution of George Pell, has not been covered anywhere on the ABC or in any of the major Nine newspapers. It has been in The Australian, of course, as has Frank's and mine. And he got one interview on Radio National, the Religion and Ethics Report. In short, members of the Pell parlon will not engage in any reconsideration of the Pell case. In my view, that's intellectual cowardice. In certain circumstances, it's censorship. Now, tonight I'd like to look at the proceedings and findings of the Royal Commission into institutional responses to child sexual abuse. The Commission's findings with respect to Pell were released in the early morning of Thursday, the 7th of May 2020, a month after the High Court judgment. They covered the Catholic Diocese of Ballarat, case study 28, and the Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne, case study 35. The critics of Pell, whose comments on and after 7th April 2020 with the High Court decision suggested that they did not accept the decision of the High Court, embraced the Royal Commission's findings with glee. For example, at 10:19 a.m. on the 7th of May, Louise Milligan tweeted that the Royal Commission had comprehensively rejected Pell's evidence. Her analysis was immediately embraced by many members of the Pell parlon, including Paul Bongiorno. Yet the Royal Commission's findings on Pell amounted to literally hundreds of pages and could not have been comprehensively read, let alone considered, in such a short time frame. The Royal Commission, as you know, was presided over by former Judge Peter McClellan, QC, with Gail Furness, SC, as counsel assisting. No other person beyond Pell was so targeted by the Royal Commission. He spent 19 hours over 4 days being cross-examined from Rome concerning Ballarat and Melbourne, and another 17 hours over two separate appearances on other matters, 36 hours in all. Now, the Royal Commission declared that its findings would be consistent with the precedent laid down by the High Court in the Brigginshaw case in the 1930s, that is, the test of reasonable satisfaction. This entails that the more serious the allegation, the higher level of proof required before a finding amounting to reasonable satisfaction of an event having taken place is made. The Royal Commission did not apply this standard with respect to Cardinal Pell. There was no verbal or written evidence against Pell, none whatsoever. That's why the Royal Commission found that it was variably inconceivable, implausible, untenable and unlikely that he did not know about clerical child sexual abuse. These are words that are used when there's no evidence. This is not a proof of any standard, including the Brigginshaw test. One example illustrates the point with respect to the notorious paedophile Gerald Ridsdale, who has been in prison in Victoria since 1994. Without witness or documentary evidence, the Royal Commission found that Pell was present at a consultors' meeting on the 19th of July 1977 when Bishop Moore Kearns, the Bishop of Ballarat, said that Ridsdale was sexually assaulting boys. The Royal Commission also found that Father Madden, who was at the meeting, would have been told about the offending. This appears at page 267 of case study 28. However, earlier at page 74 of the same document, the Royal Commission accepted that Father Madden did not know that Ridsdale was a paedophile until 1988, that is, over a decade after the event. a decade after the July 1977 meeting. This kind of inconsistency would require a rewrite or mainly possibly result in a failure in a first-year law study, a law school study. But it appeared in a Royal Commission finding, which cost around $350 million and was repeated any one time with hundreds of staff. It wasn't fact-checked, and there was another similar failure. Such fundamental errors concerning Pell cannot be challenged or corrected since. There is no right of appeal against the findings of a Royal Commission. You can't go to the High Court. There was also a denial of due process. The Royal Commission found that when Archbishop Melbourne Pell failed to act quickly enough concerning the paedophile priest Father Bill Baker. In fact, Pell fired Baker within a day of receiving a negative report on him from Peter O'Callaghan QC. Yet Pell was not asked any questions about Baker by Galph Ernest during the many hours he was in the witness box at the Royal Commission, and he was not given the opportunity to respond to its adverse draft findings about his handling of Baker. This is a clear denial of due process. The Royal Commission found that 60% of those who complained of child sexual abuse, most of which related to the period of the 1960s and the 1970s, in a religious institution were in Catholic institutions. But it overlooked the fact that at this time the Catholic Church ran its own independent education system, along with numerous orphanages, hospitals and the like. In other words, around 80% of children in religious institutions at the time would have been in Catholic institutions. This suggests that a child in a religious institution in the 1960s and 70s would have been safer in a Catholic than in a non-Catholic religious institution. We have no figures for government institutions. When I asked Robert Fitzgerald about this, a member of the Royal Commission, he said that he and his colleagues had made no prevalent studies of this kind, but they might in the future. He then avoided the question and soon after went into off-the-record mode. Due to its overwhelming focus on the Catholic Church and to a lesser extent the Anglican Church, the Royal Commission let many a government institution off the hook, in particular state police forces and government education departments. Victoria Police knew that Monsignor John Daly and Father Gerald Ridsdale were sexually assaulting boys in the Ballarat Diocese as early as 1972 and 1975, respectively. They knew it. But Victoria Police did nothing about this and even forced an honest policeman, a Catholic named Dennis Ryan, out of the force for wanting to prosecute Day. Mr. Ryan did not receive an apology from Victoria Police until 2016, and he was not compensated for losing his job until 2018. The Royal Commission made no specific criticism of Victoria Police concerning its dangerous, unprofessional and incompetent handling of the Day and Ridsdale cases. And then there's the matter of government schools. The Royal Commission paid scant attention to historical child sexual abuse in government schools. It conducted a total of 57 case studies, including 16 related specifically to the Catholic Church. But the Royal Commission did not conduct even one case study into a government school. The Royal Commission conducted only one case study in Tasmania concerning the Hutchins School, an independent boys' school with an Anglican background. In August 2020, as recent as that, the Tasmanian government set up the independent inquiry into the Tasmanian Department of Education's responses to child sexual abuse. It found cases where the Tasmanian department had moved paedophile teachers from school to school between the early 70s and the 1990s. The Royal Commission didn't even see this. And then there's the St Andrews Katanning Hostel in Western Australia, an institution run by the Western Australian government at the time as a hostel for schoolchildren. For 15 years, the paedophile Dennis McKenna assaulted boys. He went to prison eventually. An inquiry by the Honourable Peter Blacksall QC, a retired judge in 2012, found that McKenna's offending was widely known at the time by public officials and others, including prominent members of the Western Australian community, none of whom did anything about it. And the case is documented by Maggie Dawkins in an article in the January 2019 issue of Whistleblower. The only case study the Royal Commission conducted in Western Australia involved Catholic orphanages and schools. Didn't touch the government and didn't touch this scandalous case, which was widely known at the time. The Royal Commission's failure to undertake case studies into government institutions or the media industry, it didn't touch the media either, along with its soft handling of state police forces, played a clear role in creating the impression that this was a royal commission into the Catholic Church in general and Cardinal Pell in particular. Most media institutions and most journalists who covered the Pell case were hostile to the Cardinal. The Royal Commission in its own particular way contributed to the Pell pylon and to the atmosphere of collective guilt, namely the view that somehow or other George Pell carried a responsibility for the crimes of others. In such an environment, the possibility of an accused receiving a fair trial was remote, to say the least. But 2 years ago, the High Court resolved this matter to the long-term benefit of the Australian legal system. Thank you.
I'm going to lead off with one question, which has been bugging me ever since Pell was exonerated, and even before. We're talking about lessons to be learned from the Pell saga. I want to know what the church, the Catholic Church, should learn from this saga, because to my mind, it's very much a bit like the crucifixion when all the apostles ran away. I'm not a very faithful Catholic anymore, I'm a cultural Catholic, but from where I stand, the bulk of the Catholic Church left Pell on his own. So what's the lesson to be learned? Three people. You right? Coming up?
I'll start off briefly. I just want to say something that I think many people know, that Father Frank Brennan is not a Catholic of the kind of Catholic theology that Cardinal Pell espouses. And Frank Brennan was immensely courageous to take the position that he took. He wasn't a close friend of Cardinal Pell, but he stood for justice. Now, as to other parts of the church, it was in a very difficult position. I think it was not easy for the church to stand up on these matters. But some people stood up, and I think enough people stood up to make a difference. I think Archbishop Fisher did very well in Sydney. I wouldn't say the same for some of the other bishops. But what would I know, Frank?
I was commissioned by Archbishop Coleridge, President of the Bishops' Conference, and Archbishop Fisher as the Vice President of the Bishops' Conference to observe proceedings and to make observations that were accurate once suppression orders were lifted. And I think that was a useful thing for the church to do. I was surprised that there wasn't stronger stands taken by our bishops generally around Australia, I have to say. But I think that a lot of them, as they said themselves at the end of the Royal Commission, they were like rabbits in a spotlight. And I think they were just feeling very punch drunk. And I think, like a lot of Australians, they thought, well, let's just hope this caravan can move on. I didn't see that the caravan could just move on, because what I saw was, I'm not only a priest, but I'm also a lawyer, and I saw a very radical threat to the rule of law when the populist mob, with the backing of some key media and journalists, could create an atmosphere which could be so detrimental to the operation of the rule of law. And I think for a number of our bishops, that sort of argument was probably seen to be a bit above their pay grade.
Look, I can understand why they didn't speak up. Obviously, they'd just been through the Royal Commission and kept getting beaten down. And any time they put their head above on any moral issue, and we saw it, whether it was, you know, marriage, abortion, anything, so, you know, how dare you? You don't have the right to speak on moral matters anymore. So I can see that, you know, they were camera shy even before this occurred. So I understand that. I think that one of the big lessons, I'd say there's probably three. One of the big lessons is that we need to be very clear that seeking the truth is not anti-victim, that the truth serves victims just as much as it serves the accused. We all want the truth. And I think that sometimes we kind of think pursuing the truth and defending the truth can certainly be anti-victim, and we need to declare that that's not the case and declare it emphatically. The second thing I'll say is that this isn't just a job for the bishops. We always point to the bishops and say the bishop should do this and the bishop should do that. I actually think that the laity also failed in this regard, and especially failed in this regard. We have a voice in this debate as well. Not in this debate, but in these types of matters as well. And I think that not only did the bishops go absent, but the laity, who had less to lose in some circumstances, didn't speak up. And so that's on all of us Catholic laity too. And I think the third lesson is they're going to hate us anyway, so you might as well get out there. It's not like if you temper your language around these things and don't come and stand up that the media is all of a sudden going to gush over the Catholic Church and say how wonderful we are. They're not. So you might as well just, you know, roll with the punches.
Thanks, Saul. We have a question down the back from Keith, and then we've got one from Charles Sweeney.
Sorry, my it's not really a question, it's a comment on the answers that people have given. There's one more factor which I think was very important in this. The fact that the trial was virtually a secret trial, both of the trials. Peter Kidd forbade the publication of the evidence of the main complainant. And anybody at the end of the trial even the journalists who were there were not allowed to hear what the choir boy accused Pell of doing. We only found out about it when Kidd made his final judgment. And all we had was the jury verdict and a fairly brief statement by Kidd. And so I still don't understand why the whole thing was so secret. I've read the protection sort of orders that sexual abuse cases have surrounding them, and some of those sympathise with the people who have been assaulted this way, and they're impeccable. But when you consider the rule of law and the obligation to be fair, and traditional Australianisms like fair go. I found the Kidd thing, one of the things that, you know, dragged me to the thing was what the bloody hell happened? What was actually going on there? Because we didn't know. And so anybody who wanted to defend Church, apart from Frank Brennan, who went through the trial and had the transcripts, nobody else knew what was going on.
Let's try. Anyone want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. I think to be fair to Justice Kidd, the suppression orders were sought by both sets of counsel, the Crown and Pell's counsel, and that was in order to ensure fairness if there was to be a future trial regarding the swimming pools. But I think a downside of such a suppression order is, as you rightly say, if there hadn't been suppression orders, there would have been daily press reports which would have given the unfolding of, for example, the complainant's changing story about the routes that he took. Initially, he said, well, I just went, you know, internally and only took 56 steps. By the time he gets to the end of his case, it takes 5.5 minutes. How did that possibly happen? Or, for example, the fifth charge, which I've always said was like the 13th strike of a clock. If there'd been routine media reporting of the fifth charge, namely that Pell at the end of a mass had gone up through 50 to 70 people in a corridor and cornered this kid in the presence of all the others, put him against the wall and sexually assaulted him, and that the police did not interview one single person about that allegation, there would have been, maybe not in The Age, but at least in the Herald Sun, there would have been a statement, well, hang on, we thought police generally interview people. Now, hang on, he was standing beside a named individual, Father Brendan Egan, who'd left the priesthood, therefore couldn't be said, you know, just wanting to put the Catholic line or whatever. The police had never spoken to him. Or if there'd been more coverage of the committal, for example, that there were two women, including a retired headmistress, who used to supervise that corridor because there were so many Taiwanese tourists turning up when the cathedral had been reopened. Guess what? The police have never spoken to those two women. What's going on? That would have been seen if there'd been routine press reporting by agencies like the Herald Sun.
Okay, anyone else want to have a go? Okay, we've got a question here from the Zoom. Do you want to say something, Monica?
No.
Question from the Zoom from Charles Sweeney. He asks, is the elephant in the room the quality of Victorian judicial appointments?
Charles, yes. Charles Sweeney, QC.
Of the Melbourne Bar.
Well, I would say that if you look at the Victorian Court of Appeal, the appointments of the government might be reflected in the majority judges, but I must say, just as Mark Weinberg's dissent was probably the most important dissent in Australian criminal law history, So that appointment was correct, but that went back a long way. He comes out, you just give us his background of Mark Weinberg.
Mark Weinberg was the preeminent criminal appeal judge in the country. He'd been the Commonwealth DPP. He knew what prosecutions were about. That highlights how appalling the decision of the majority was. Ferguson was the new Chief Justice. She could be forgiven for not knowing much criminal law. But she brought Weinberg in from retirement to sit on this case, knowing it would have national and international significance. Weinberg wrote the perfect 200-page dissenting judgment, simply analysing the evidence and analysing the jurisprudence of the High Court of Australia. Ferguson decided for some reason not to go with that. Maxwell, as president of the Court of Appeal, had had a long-running campaign saying we have to believe juries in these sorts of cases. But even Maxwell has to accept, hang on, you had Brett Walker, the leading silk of the country, admittedly from north of the Murray, but appearing there before you, and you then had Weinberg, the leading criminal appeal judge of the country, putting it all out there, but you decided to go off on a rampage of your own, which was just completely illogical and not based on the evidence, and that the High Court was able to deal with that unanimously, 7-0. So, in terms of these appointments, I'm sure there's very good judicial work they've done in other areas. But here what we see is the leadership of the Victorian bench at a time when there was a public clamour failed disastrously and the rule of law was very ill served, and we should all be thankful to Justice Weinberg.
Right, we have two questions out the back. Scott first and then Brian.
Look, I just want to step outside the...
Talk into the microphone.
I just want to step outside the Catholic ecosystem and firstly declare I'm not part of the laity. I'm an Anglican for my sins and probably a failed one. But I did find myself dragged into the Pell matter as a, in a sense, not even a defender, but an interested party that couldn't believe what I was watching from afar. And my question to probably Gerard is to make a comment about whether or not this is bigger than just the Pell attack, and whether it's not more of a reflection of a general malaise that exists in our approach to things like the rule of law and censorship and freedom of speech, and whether or not Pell is just but the most iconic example of this stuff out of control. And where do we go from here? Because, for me it's a concern.
Well, that's an important point. I was interviewed by Lyle Shelton, who couldn't be here tonight, on his podcast shortly after the book came out. And I made the point there that I think the reason for the antagonism to George Pell was not that he was a Catholic so much, but that he was a conservative Catholic. And I think you find some similar criticisms against conservative Anglicans, conservative Protestants, and other members of conservative religions. And of course, a lot of the people who were Pell's most fierce critics were former Catholics who become bitter anti-Catholics, or bitter anti-conservative Catholics in any event. So I think it was a broader view, but it was just that Pell was probably the most prominent conservative in the country, and he was conservative on social matters, and I trace some of this in the book, the chapter I've done on him in the book, and so I think your point is right. I think we're probably going to see more of this, and it's not the only country where this is occurring in, but this was the case that that I think drew significant attention to it. I'll just briefly add, Louise Milligan's a born in Ireland, a former Catholic. You quoted the transcript that you did after the 7:30 report, the famous 7:30 report. Now, you've got your own transcript, and I have my copy of that transcript. But this is a rare document now because the ABC has pulled it off, the transcripts, and it's pulled all the whole program off. So if you go and look at the ABC online, it was like on the night that they did 30 minutes on Pell, it never happened. You've got the program for Monday, you've got the program for Tuesday. Wednesday, everyone obviously went to the pub and nothing happened. Then you got the program for Thursday. Now, so this has now become a rare document, and you've got, well, together we've got, but the idea that the ABC, without explanation, without reason, would just put this down what George Orwell called the memory hole, tells a bit about the impact of the case on the ABC, although they won't talk about it. I'm happy to provide copies, by the way.
We may auction it later. Brian?
A question perhaps on the interaction between the Royal Commission and the Pearl prosecution. And to what extent do you think that the tactics of the Truth, Justice, Healing Council in a fair bit of acquiescence in the process of the Royal Commission, policy not to vigorously cross-examine complainants and the like, set up a mood where the perhaps Victorian police and prosecutors were emboldened that, in effect, this would be a simple lay-down-dead prosecution?
Well, I'll take that briefly. Brian Lucas is mentioned in my book and comes out favourably, and and he is not really in the Pearl card either. I mean, I'm critical of the Truth, Healing and Justice Committee, whatever its precise name was. My view was that what should have happened was this, and I said it for a long time, that the Catholics who appeared, the official Catholic response to the inquiry should have said, to the Royal Commission should have said, the Catholic Church made some dreadful mistakes, as did most other institutions, religious and secular at the time. But Cardinal Pell in Melbourne in 1996 and the other bishops and archbishops outside of Melbourne in 1997 brought in the Melbourne response towards healing, and the Catholic Church addressed it, and it started addressing it in the mid-90s before virtually any other organisation, religious or secular. But they didn't do that. Instead, they went forward and made constant apologies and didn't advance the case. So the case presented, if you just watch the Royal Commission, apart from Pell's own counsel, who appeared, you would get the impression that there was no response to these allegations. I think it was grievously mishandled, and I'm quite critical of Francis Sullivan in the book. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether others wanted to get into that.
Go on.
I might just give a quick example of one of the things that stood out in the Truth, Justice and Healing Council response to the Royal Commission. During the Ballarat case study, there was the case of Father Peter Searson, who was accused of not only abuse, but of all other types of sort of strange behaviour around the kids, like, you know, showing them dead animals and all of those types of things. And the Cardinal came under a lot of criticism about his time as auxiliary bishop. And one of the things that became apparent was that there was a delegation of teachers from that school who went to have a meeting with then Auxiliary Bishop Pell. And the Royal Commission called four witnesses from the Catholic Education Office, none of them who were at that meeting, two of them who had never met Cardinal Pell before in their life, but who all gave evidence along the lines of, oh, yes, certainly in that meeting he would have been told A, B, C, D about Peter Searson. With that, no basis at all. Not all of them were just speculating. None of them were in the meeting. The Truth, Justice and Healing Council, in their submissions to the Royal Commission, said that the evidence of those four witnesses should have been accepted. In any type of, you know, in any true treatment of that, you would say none of them were there. They shouldn't have been called by the Royal Commission, let alone have their evidence accepted. So not only in part did they not challenge the witness or the victim testimony, but even when there were witnesses that weren't victims who could have been challenged and who should have been challenged, the Truth, Justice and Healing Council encouraged the Royal Commission to accept their evidence. Like, it was an absolute disaster. They were playing a PR game, I think, rather than necessarily a truth game. And I've said it before, but worrying about what the media thinks about the church's response is what got us into this spot in the first place and what gave us the first Royal Commission, and we behave that way in a different respect to the second one.
I'd just say, I think that VicPol and the DPP, by overplaying their hand and not following the rules, I think they did great damage, because I think the Catholic Church was an institution which needed state help, regardless of the failings of other institutions. We needed state help. I said that in a major talk here in Parliament House in Sydney in 2012. And having sought state help, I think the service we were given in looking forward, particularly for the care of bona fide complainants and victims, was, I think, not of the standard you would expect for a $350 million Royal Commission. And I think the prosecution of Pell basically crueled the pitch for the capacity, particularly in Victoria, for working in a trusting way forward where state institutions could be relied upon, where we could say, I mean, particularly those of us Catholics who say, look, there should be nothing to hide. Sure, put whatever spotlight you light on us, even if you don't put it on everyone else, nothing to hide, please put the spotlight on. We want truth, justice and healing. But what was done by the DPP and by VicPol in this case showed that what you're dealing with is a very flawed state institution. And so finding the way forward remains difficult.
Well, I think those last three comments sum it up, don't you? Oh, there's another question. Okay, last question. I wasn't sure. I couldn't see.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to ask you a question.
And, you need to push the microphone up so it burps and then put it to your mouth.
Yes.
Such a horrendous injustice done to such a fine man. But even the, now the conviction has been revoked. But I think, the damage is, down is not repairable. But that's why I'd really like to know, if you can give us also some information about Appel, what's happened to him now. And also the opposite, what happened to the accuser? I mean, what kind of punishment they should receive? Thank you very much.
I might comment first on just on the accuser, and then maybe let someone else comment on the cardinal. But you can't punish accusers. It would go against public policy to say to an alleged victim of sexual abuse, if you come forward but you lose, we'll punish you. Right? You still want to do everything you can to encourage people to come forward, and not make punishment contingent on whether or not their case is successful.
In terms of the accuser, those of you who are in the courtroom for the hearing of the appeal, you would have known the Crown made a mistake and disclosed his identity. And any of us who attended the hearings of the case know his identity. We're not at liberty to disclose it. But if you want to, quite a number of people do, you can follow him. He goes on Twitter every day. He's got his own blog, he publishes articles on various websites, etc. He gives interviews, not about this matter, but about all sorts of other matters. He's a great critic of the Morrison government and of the Labor Party and the Murdoch Press and the Nine Papers and Channel 10 and all of that. So as far as one can judge, I mean, he's getting on with his life, and good luck to him. In terms of Cardinal Pell, as I understand, he's back in Rome. He's over 80, so he's not eligible to vote in a conclave. But no doubt, being Cardinal Pell, he'll play a key role with the murmurings that go on about the choice of the next pope. And clearly, with this trial with Cardinal Bacciu, I mean, he went to Rome with a clear job of cleaning up the Vatican finances, and he was thwarted in that. And even his greatest critics should admit he was on about the right thing there, and he was on a winner. And he was thwarted in a very unfair fashion. And so, I don't know, but I presume he's doing what he can to get that train back on track. And I'd say good luck to him.
Just briefly on the first point, of course, the scandalous case in Britain of that guy, Nick, who's gone to prison for a long term, who made allegations of child sexual assault against people like the late Sir Edward Heath, other senior British politicians who lied, and he was convicted because he lied, and he's serving a long prison sentence for that. But short of someone who's lying, and is proved to have been lying, of course, anyone who's a complainant remains a complainant and not a victim in this case, but a complainant, and has the right to anonymity under the law. As to George Pell, well, I think Frank's right. We don't know when the next pope will be chosen. We don't know when the current pope's going to die or possibly retire. But I think whilst George Pell doesn't have a vote in the conclave, because he's over 80, I think he has a right to speak. And what happens before the...
He does.
What's it called? The...
Memoratio.
The memoratio. He has a right to... He has a right to rally the troops before the team runs out on the field. I think that's it. And I'm sure he'll be doing that.
Just wait, you three. Well, thank you all. That's a great ending. Funny to think that at the end of this, George Pell has ended up as an influencer. He can go down with all those other long-leggy influencers. We've had a most comprehensive, accessible, understandable 30 minutes on a most complicated and complex topic. You've done brilliantly, the three of you. We've got for sale Frank Brennan's, I'll get it right this time, Observations on the Pell Proceedings, which is a second expanded edition, which Frank will sign, and more of Cardinal Pell Media Pylon and Collective Guilt. And if you buy both, you'll get it for $50 all up. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for coming, folks.